Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I'm here with Alex Wade, the author of Playback, a genealogy of 1980s British video games. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Rebecca. Thanks for having me today.
Yes. So I'm wondering if you could start out by talking about how you got interested in this topic and why you wanted to write this book.
So I think this probably goes back to my undergraduate days when I was studying at Keele University in the UK, and I was doing a sociology undergraduate degree, and I was going through all the normal stuff that, you know, sociologists go through, like population and class and things like that. And I just thought, well, one of the kind of hints that you get about, you know, writing about things is write about what you know. And I thought, well, I've played video games all my life, so I'll write about games. And I wrote a dissertation on it, and It won the best dissertation prize for sociology in that year. And after that, I took it forwards. And I wrote my doctorate on a similar kind of topic around games. And I could see even at that point, there was a lot of stuff around history and games that wasn't been explored. And I touched on it being my doctorate. And then I took it forwards from this book. So the inspiration really comes from the fact that it's such a massive topic, but very few people will explore it. And in actual fact, although this is a book about UK video games, most of the interest does seem to come from the US, which is strange. And I think that it's interesting the way that certainly American audiences have responded to it. It's not necessarily been something that's been picked up so much in the UK, but it's been much more prevalent in the US, which is heartening. But then again, it's kind of disappointing that perhaps we don't value our culture around games quite as much as other people do.
Right. I thought that, and you talked about that a bit, about how most of the scholarship is written around gaming in the United States and not looking at gaming in the UK or outside of the United States. So that sort of gets at that idea as well, it seems. So you start out with sort of setting this up and talking about habitus and looking at sort of bedroom cultures and the different avenues that you're going to look at. So is there anything you want to sort of start out by sort of grounding us in that sort of framework that you look at as we start to talk about the rest of your book?
Well, I think the most important thing is to say, going back to what you just said about kind of US gaming and things like that, and there's so many narratives in that area, that there is a prevalence of a US, and it's unfortunate, but it's Japanese or US-centric, and that's because the hardware and the software commercially has often been seen as being from those areas. And you have people who will write, Mark J.P. Wolf writes some wonderful stuff on gaming, but it does have that, well, the 2014 book that he wrote before The Crash does have a very kind of US-centric view, whereas for us in 1983, video game industry was kind of collapsing in the US, but in the UK, it was kind of taking off in a big way there. So I think it's important to see that there are different types of histories. And so when I'm coming at it from a kind of a genealogical perspective, it's really about the fact that there are many histories around games, as there are about everything. And it's not just one that should be seen as dominant. So this was to kind of repurpose that, I guess. And there are a lot of people that, you know, in Australia and across Europe that try to do the same thing. But I also think that it's important to speak to those kind of major areas as well, like Japan and the US, and not understate the amount of influence there is there. And I think that really comes through certainly in the first and second chapters. You talk about where the game comes from, and it is, you know, video games originated in the US. So what I've tried to do is bring an international angle to it, and it's that kind of habitus. So people who were involved in, you know, railway or railroad clubs in the US, and they were working on, you know, nuclear weapons programs. So it's really to say that, yes, this is specifically British, but it's a British take on, you know, what is US culture, I guess, in that respect. So I think it's important to cut. That was really the grounding of that book. It's not just the UK. It's meant to be a kind of bringing everything to bear on the UK and understanding where it started and kind of where it's going as well.
Right. And so can you talk a little bit about the Could you talk a little bit more, maybe I should say, about that history and sort of how you historically positioned the UK? You talk a bit about, you know, the moral panic and that kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit about that sort of context and grounding?
Yeah, sure. So Martin Amis is one of our greatest writers since the late 20th century. And I think in 1982, he wrote something called Invasion of the Space Invaders. And this is quite it's not rare, it's an uncommon text. And it's actually something that Martin Amis himself kind of disavows. So he doesn't really list it in his, you know, his publications, and he won't talk about the book. And yeah, it's a wonderful text, beautifully illustrated. And in there, he has a foreword by Steven Spielberg as well. He was very into gaming at that time as well. And so he's one of the kind of early people who's positioning arcade games, certainly, within that context. And for us in the UK, when we were playing games, the arcades or the amusement arcades where video games were located would be the kind of place where a lot of these moral panics, as you call it, would happen. And that's the kind of thing that we talk about. This talks about in the book is the fact that people would, especially young people, would hang around in these arcades, and they wouldn't just be for games. They would be, you know, places where they would smoke. They would take drugs, for instance. There's lots of studies on those kind of things. But eventually, it kind of got out of control. So it became the fact that, you know, it would, you know, children would be seen to be doing kind of illicit acts with all kinds of people to get money. And one of the things that is actually in the book that George Foulkes, who was an MP at the time, he was a member of Parliament at the time, he said that a child had undertaken an act with a member of the clergy so that he could get money to put money into arcade games. But this is where the locus was. So, you know, these were kind of Al Alcorn talks about being naughty places where interesting things might happen, and that's the focus of the kind of moral panic. But the transition to a new technology is something that, you know, we see all the time. So although with arcade games it was seen as something potentially dangerous, we see the same kind of thing with social media now and the way that our kids use it. So these kind of things have replicated over generations, and those are the kind of points that I tried to make, that yes, it could be seen as dangerous, but our reaction to it is just as dangerous as well. So that was one of them. And then there's several other kind of things around that. So the arcade is one of the key moral panics. But then also these arcade games would be converted onto hardware, computers. And basically they'd be copied, and there wouldn't be any notion of – there is a notion of copyright, but it seemed to be ignored by a lot of coders, and they would, you know, effectively have to negotiate with industry people around that. So there are a lot of angles around that. People spend a lot of time in their bedrooms playing games. Of course, that happens with kids now, and that's what was happening then. So you can see a kind of, you know, through 40 years or 30 or 40 years of history, the more things change effectively, the more they stay the same.
Right, yes. And I say that too, as I have my son upstairs playing. Yeah, Fortnite is the new big, I don't know in the UK, but in the US it's Fortnite, right? But can we talk a little bit about that bedroom culture? Because I thought how you sort of brought that in was very interesting in the work that I do. I look a lot at girls at bedroom culture, but you sort of also apply that to video gaming, which becomes often a very male-centric topic. So can you talk about that idea of bedroom culture and how you sort of talk about that in your book?
Sure. I think one of the interesting things is Irving Goffman's one of the US's great sociologists, and he talks about the kind of secret consumption that goes on within bedrooms. And expressly, you know, Goffman would be talking about that as being what young girls, young women would do. So they might be, you know, 13 or 14. And the same kind of thing applies to the Centre for Contemporary Critical Studies in the UK. Quite often those bedroom cultures, as you rightly say, were looking at girls in a kind of hidden culture that would go on. So the posters that would be on the walls, the access to you know, telephones and things like that, so they could arrange dates with girlfriends and with boyfriends as well. And it was strange to see that actually when you go back to that literature, and it's such a rich literature, and there's so much wonderful stuff in there, that actually that's the study around kind of bedroom cultures ends pretty much just as the kind of as bedroom coding takes off. So for So for us in the UK, bedroom coding is a big thing. So what happened was, you know, usually it would be young males, and they could be between, you know, 13 and 19. So they would still be at school, but effectively go into their bedrooms and play games, and then they would learn how to code them as well. So they'd learn how to program these games. And they would spend hours upon hours kind of integrating with the technology that was there, and then programming these games individually. Maybe send them off to publishers, and then when the, you know, the publishers would then, you know, sell them on. So you have this kind of very private activity, which is very close to a cottage industry, you know, a very kind of close relationship with the means of production and the actual product at the end of it. But then that becomes very public in the sense that it's promoted publicly through publishers. But then you have the magazines at the other end as well, who are also advertising it, reviewing it, pushing it, doing those kind of things. So it's really interesting that it was just at that point, and I think that was really the key thing for me, that kind of habitus, if you like, was kind of ignored by scholars in many ways. And I think that was a real shame, because there was a massive opportunity for looking at this very rich area. But it's also worth mentioning the kind of gender angle here, because during the 1980s, there were a lot of there were some studies done on girls and gaming, and it was at that point, it was pretty much a 50-50 split. So, you know, girls would game. Quite often they would do it in kind of front rooms, lounges, those kind of things, as a family thing, whereas boys would perhaps do it more privately. And then over time, it became less so. So it would be more about boys doing it rather than girls. And Graham Kirkpatrick kind of picks up on that it becomes quite a misogynist kind of culture, which I do agree with up to a certain point, but I think he overstates the case a little bit. But it's interesting to see that also has become quite apparent. So you've had things like Gamergate in the US, which became a kind of international mm-hmm. problem or an international issue. And that kind of thing, I think it all kind of develops from that kind of area. So it's interesting to see, again, historically, you can, if you trace back, you can see where these things have come from over time. So that's really... I think that's fascinating. I think there's a lot more in that as well.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it sort of parallels with comics, right? Like younger boys and girls, even split with comics, but we get to now and we look at it very different. And you sort of touched on it, but I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about that copying culture and that idea of the copying culture, because it seems to be a very important aspect of how sort of these gaming networks were created and kept going.
Yeah, that is a big thing. And it certainly seemed to be a big thing in Europe at the time. So, and again, that's the influence of technology in the bedroom. So During the 1980s, the same I'm sure was true in the US as well. What would happen was you have things that we would call them ghetto blasters or things like that, and you know, there'd be large kind of hi-fis with two speakers on them. But interestingly, they also have two cassette decks on them as well. So in the UK, we used cassette tapes or analog cassette tapes, and you would borrow a game off a friend, and you would use the other cassette tape or the cassette deck to copy that game, and then you would distribute that in kind of playgrounds. People would sell them on. And as that technology became more kind of advanced around discs and things like that, that became quite the mod scene became quite big in Europe. But before that point, actually, I think it's highlighted in the book. What happens is that it goes behind the Iron Curtain, effectively. So you go into Poland, and there's a guy there called, I think his name's Tchaikovsky, and effectively he's got a kind of whole copying network set up where he's making copies of games, and then he's distributing them throughout Eastern Europe. This is before, you know, the USSR had fallen in the 1980s. And then he said I don't know how much of this is actually true. It's kind of secondhand data that have been used, but he was saying that he was using the Polish Olympic team to get new titles, and he was distributing it through them. So I think that those networks that are in place, they come from a private place with the bedroom, but the technologies that were there enabled this to spread very, very quickly and under the radar as well, because people just it was going on, and you know, people were quite accepting of it. It wasn't a professional industry. You know, you'd sell one copy, and then there would be 10 bootleg copies, you know, shared amongst friends. So if you sold one copy for £10, effectively you're missing out on another £100 worth of sales. And although disks tried to stop doing that, it didn't really stop it. It just, those networks are already embedded and they're still used. They're still used to this day in many respects as well. So it's, I think that's a really key part of how it got people, especially young boys, interested in some, well, young boys, I say young, like 14-year-old boys, interested in gaming, because they were able to do this kind of away from the surveillance of their parents, and they could do that in bedrooms, like with comics, as you said, and like with magazines for girls as well.
And I'm guessing it was in some ways cheaper for them to be able to do that than...
Well, yeah, it would be. I mean, I'm speaking from personal experience, but I would rent a game off someone, so someone would actually come around my house, or come around to my dad's house, it would have been, with a car, and they would, it is like a boot sale. You'd open up the boot, and in the boot they'd have loads of games, and you'd rent the game off them and then take it off them for a week, copy it, give it to your friends, then copy it. And then, you do it like on a kind of rotary basis. So each friend would take, one or two games each week. And so you'd end up with six games effectively each week that you owned. You didn't have to go out and buy them. So a game would cost, say, £10 to buy, but it'd be £1.50 to kind of hire for a week. And it's interesting the way those kind of things perpetuated. The technology allowed it, but there were, these networks were, they're quite informal. They would be done through playgrounds, where people were making money on the back of renting these games as well. So you would be, it'd be massively cheaper. You just buy five blank tapes for say £5, and then you could fill it up with games. 90 minutes probably fit three or four games on it. So it was quite different in those respects, where you have that kind of immediate access to tapes and things like that, which we're kind of a bit more distanced from technology now. It's more, the platforms are more locked down. Unless you're a coder, it's difficult to kind of get to the kind of different areas. So it was a lot more immediate. It's like coding to metal, if you like.
Right. Yeah. And no, that makes sense. So, and you move from, so this bedroom culture is really important. And you brought this up earlier, but I'd like you to talk maybe a little bit more too. Then you move into the arcades, right? And what that means. And so that subculture. And so can you talk a bit more about that and the importance of the arcades in your work?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the things is that it's starting to be picked up in some of the literature. I mentioned it in there, but I think it's becoming kind of more evident as time goes on, is the fact that although these were places effectively that were based around kind of moral panics, and that would be the same in the US as it would be in the UK, but it was also the fact that these were also places that were embedded in other areas as well. So I'll give the example of Rand Corporation, where people would play war games underground. And, what, for me, I'm really asking, what's the difference between, elites kind of doing it at Rand, these very clever people probably been to elite US universities, and then people, kids, and not just kids, but all kinds of sections of society would be doing it in arcades. They would effectively be using games like Missile Command or Defender, which give this kind of very Cold War kind of paranoia feel to the whole kind of culture. So if you watch War Games, for instance, it's got that kind of thing that's attached to it, the original, the 1983 original, not the remake.
The good one.
Yeah, the original. So I think that's really the key thing here, that this technology is not just a subculture that is causing a moral panic, but this is a subculture that's come technologically from a global panic, and it is effectively driven by Cold War technologies. And it's not just to do with the technology that's used on screen or the development of the games, but it's the content of those games as well. So Missile Command is about protecting cities from attack. And then you've got Space Invaders, so you've got, aliens coming down, and that kind of, the B-movie kind of thing that comes from that, aliens, attacking the world, which is something that was, which never really goes away, but it seemed to be the late 20th century was very much into that kind of thing. So it's not just kind of one area of subculture. I think there's lots of things that feed into this. And I think that kind of, that influence of technology, I don't want to say it's technologically determined, but you can't underestimate the influence that humans have when they use technologies in certain ways. And eventually, all technology is going to be used for either sex or games. That's what happens eventually. The same happens with the internet. you know, it must always become about those kind of things, very kind of base things, and usually around enjoyment. And it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, someone who's trying to prevent or start a nuclear war, or someone who's, you know, looking to waste a few coins passing the time. It almost always just come back to games and you know, enjoyment, and war games are one of those areas.
So, and you mentioned sort of, you talk about sort of what it comes back to, but you also in this chapter talk about sort of gambling and sort of arcade games and wealth and employment and sort of that idea of gaming the game. So can you talk a little bit about that too and how that applies to your work?
Yeah, sure. So that, I mean, that's really, really interesting, because what we'd have picked up on there is that I did some kind of primary interviews with people who worked in arcades during the 1970s, 1980s. And what they were saying was that you would have over time, and this would start, say, in Victorian Britain, that amusement arcades were places where people who were working all of the time would go to spend their time. So eventually, I think in the late 19th century, the UK government said you can have kind of certain times off. So you can have holidays, mandatory holidays, like bank holidays, we call them here. So it'd be public holidays where people have that time off. And they would go to these places like Blackpool, for instance, or Southend, and they would spend time spending money. And originally, like at that point, so, you know, 130, 140 years ago, that would be around gambling. And a lot of those were about, you know, the joy of the carnival, if you like. So people would go there. And it wasn't really the fact they were spending a lot of money, but they would be spending a certain amount of money on leisure. So the same kind of thing becomes apparent when you think about places like Las Vegas, for instance. You know, people go there and spend money in the pursuit of either getting money or just for the sheer enjoyment of just, you know, experiencing kind of carnival and excess, as Bataille would say. And when I kind of met with these people, they were saying that it was almost uniformly when they were kind of growing up that they would have started in these kind of electromechanical. So they would start with pinball. And pinball was a really, really big thing in the US, and that would have started out as a gambling game. And as the laws changed over time, like in Chicago and New York, for instance, you know, it would become less about luck and more about skill. And I think eventually it took New York an awful long time to get to the point where they would allow machines like pinball to actually give credits back, because they've always seen as gambling. And that's the hook, really. So gambling is the hook, and a lot of those things that those people talk about there is a fact that they would start off by gambling and then they would progress to games. But those things around, those methods of gambling, never really went away. So one interviewee was saying that, you know, he would kind of game different games. So he would look to see which gamblers were going to pay out, and he would play that gambler, he'd play that machine, and he'd wait for that. When that machine paid out, he'd take that money and then he'd put it into the video games. And also, I think there's an example from there who's saying that, you know, in change machines, you could kind of make a block of ice, effectively it looked like a 50 pence piece, put it into a machine, and you'd get money out. But the interesting thing was they wouldn't just steal the money, they wouldn't just take the money from there. What they would do was they would put the money back into the arcade machines. So what you have is a kind of internal economy, if you like. The money never really goes out, it just circulates, even though basically people are stealing, but they seem to be only stealing from each other in many respects. So it is that thing kind of applies in many kind of walks of life. Certainly in sociology, you say that poor people effectively steal from poor people, and rich people steal from, you know, rich people. And that's how that works. It becomes very kind of incestuous, maybe too strong a word, but it's certainly kind of inward looking. And that, I think that's, those kind of dynamics are interesting. And all of those people that I interviewed there, they started gaming in the 1970s, and gaming and gambling, and they're still doing the same thing today, and they still love both of them. They still love gaming and they still love gambling. It's one of those things that really hooks you. And I don't really want to talk about addiction because I'm not really an expert of it, but you can see that is a kind of the habitus, if you like, that Bourdieu talks about. It's ingrained in them and it's reproduced over time. They can't let it go. Even that the professional gambler who was, you know, pulling in maybe £3,000 on every trip to from Portsmouth to Bilbao on a ferry, so he's a professional gambler, he'd be earning a lot of money. He's taken £250,000 of his own money and put it into a video game arcade. And that kind of investment is just, you can't, that personal investment is not something you can understate. That person is living it every day. And even when I met with him, it was clear the arcade wasn't making money, but it was more than about money for him. It was about realizing a kind of lifetime dream that probably popped up in childhood. So again, it's that thing that runs from childhood all the way through to adult life.
Right. Yeah. Well, it makes me think of because my son's a big gamer, he just went out and bought a new, it's a whole new thing, but it's like a little Atari joystick, but you can plug it into your computer and it plays old games. Right. And this idea, and there's so many people who collect, collect games that are outdated. And this sort of moves into your sort of formatting wars, because there's that nostalgia there, because there's that memory, and those games are so important, right, to that history. And so you move in, so you move from talking about arcades, but you talk about the sort of platform loyalties and the hardware and how that becomes important, and sort of the Commodore 64 and the Sinclair Spectrum. And so can you talk a bit about that and the importance of those hardwares and what that meant?
Yeah, sure. So in the UK, we would have, so Spectrum was from a scientist, or he was seen as a boffin, really, Sir Clive Sinclair, and he developed very cheap technology, and that would have been around, stereos, hi-fis, those kind of things. And often that was kind of build your own. And he had a series of computers that started off with, probably the ZX80 would be the first one that's well known commercially, and the ZX81. So they were named after the years of the that they were released. And then the really big one was the ZX Spectrum. It was called that because it had colours on screen. So the Spectrum was effectively to do with that. And it had a little rainbow at the bottom of the screen, at the bottom of the keyboard. This was really, really tricky to code for. So this would have rubber keys. Mm. So if you remember the kind of very early, very, very early kind of mobile phones, if you can imagine trying to send a text on that. But then these people who were using these, the coders that were using this, would actually be trying to write, 1,000 lines of code perhaps on a rubber keyboard. So the nice keyboard you have now, they were out. And then, of course, you have the Commodore 64, which is a very relatively advanced piece of kit imported from the US. And for Commodore, the UK market was very important. They had offices in the UK. And they would use these computers because, consoles now, if your son's playing on an Xbox or a PS4, they're a closed platform that's very difficult to code for. But what you could do with these was, if you could play a game, you could also code on them, and you could introduce your own kind of twist on different kinds of games as well. And this was really based around the fact that these coders would bring these kind of twists to arcade games. And it was especially within the context of the UK at that time, it's difficult to overstate how kind of bad it was in the 1980s for a lot of young people. It was difficult getting into work. Mm-hmm. And game would be a way out of that. And also it would actually offer them a way into work as well. So they could control their employment. They could go to college, go to work. They would also be able to access kind of state benefits at the same time as coding. And in many respects, those kind of things have gone from the UK. So you don't have that kind of freedom, if you like, to be creative, because the state won't pay for you to stay off work while you code video games or make music. And that it does intersect with a very creative time in the UK, but also globally. So I think it's not necessarily just to do with, the particular social setup of the UK at that time, but it was also to do with the introduction of new technologies, and people could experiment with them. And I think if you think about the Commodore 64, so the chip tunes are very big. So a lot of contemporary artists will continue to use the Commodore 64 as a way, an emulation of the Commodore 64 to make music. And that kind of thing doesn't go away. So you can see just how important the technology is there. But the social context was important in the way that kind of fed into it as well. And the format wars is interesting because what it does, they effectively tried to drive each other. So the magazines would talk about, you know, how much they hated the Commodore and how much they hated the Spectrum, how much they hated the Amstrad, but they were all the same staff working on the same magazine. So they'd all be kind of working in the same place, but churning out copy that was effectively propaganda in many ways. And that would drive, you know, playground wars. So people would, you know, hate on the Commodore, hate on the Spectrum. And it was interesting to see how that kind of played out. So at one level, you've got these networks that are around distribution, but also you've got kind of competition that goes on as well, which seems to be a hallmark of capitalism, I guess, the way those kind of things work.
Well, and it still continues, right? And it continues to create sort of this, the basis for the video gaming industry and what that looks like, right? So if you have this platform, you can play these games. If you have this other, but you can't play certain other games and that kind of thing too. And how many platforms do you need? And all of that.
Well, that's right. Yeah. So yeah, exactly. And the interesting thing is we have a platform where you could play all of these. It's called the PC, and that's been around for, how long has that been around for?
Yeah.
30 years. The IBM has been around. So we could all just play PCs. But even things like Steambox, which are based on that kind of architecture, doesn't really take off for some reason. And a lot of it is around, it's around branding, and it is around that propaganda that comes through, and it's still very evident in magazines. Obviously, the internet's taken a lot of that on, but you know, there's still that propagation of format wars. And like you rightly say, PlayerUnknown Battlegrounds, for instance, could be played on an Xbox or a PC, but you can't play it on PS4. I'm not sure about Fortnite. I don't think I'm young enough to know about that, but I've got the feeling that it might be an exclusive to one of those consoles. And you have that, and it's the software is the driver. And what I found during this was like HD, you know, HD TV, which came in the kind of early 21st century, around 2003, only really took off when the Xbox 360 was released. And computer games and their hardware have always driven technology, and I think that's something that's overlooked in many ways. So things like disk drives would come with computers, and video games would be used on those. And then you have HD TV, Bluetooth technologies when you've got, you know, wireless controllers and things like that. So these are all kind of tried out and kind of perfected through video game platforms and video game technology. Hardware but software is just as important. You can't release a console without having a list of killer apps that go alongside it, because otherwise it would just sink.
Right. No, I found that really interesting too when reading your book and thinking about how, yes, so there's so many games that are now, I can at Fortnite, because Fortnite, it's apparently huge with anyone who is like 12 to 14. But like now they're coming out with an app, right? Now I can get, eventually I can play Fortnite on my phone, but it's all like, I think of Pokemon Go and all those kinds of things where it started in one system and it started as, you know, a certain program. And then because of its popularity, it's moved into more convenient for people who aren't like hardcore gamers. Right. And that's really interesting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's one of the things when you think about that, that's become, it's a very casual game, Pokemon, in many respects, but it did start off as very niche, didn't it? So, and I think originally it would be a card game that's effectively made the transition across media to mobile platforms, and that's where it becomes embedded. And in fact, now more people play games maybe on Facebook or on mobile phones than they would on consoles. So gaming's mainstream. It's not, you can't look at it any other way, and yet it still has that kind of, you know, quite a bit of a dirty attachment to it, I suppose. And it's interesting the way people say, oh, you're a gamer, or so what do you do, spend all day in your basement playing games? I mean, that's sometimes how it feels. Even now, you wouldn't put it on your CV, I'm a gamer, but you might say, I'll go to the cinema to watch films. So yeah, it's interesting.
No, that just makes me laugh, because if you ask people, even if they're playing Candy Crush or whatever it might be, if you say, tell me what a gamer looks like, it's going to be, yes, what, you're somebody who, you know, drinks Mountain Dew and eats chips and stays in their basement for like 4 days straight, right? That's that idea with, they're doing the same thing. They're playing those games just in a mobile platform. You sort of come to like your sort of the end of your final chapter, or, you know, your final chapter sort of get at that idea of like the politics of the video games and British video games in the 1980s and how that helps you understand sort of like the class in Britain. So can you talk a little bit about that and how this sort of this investigation into sort of the gaming in the 1980s helps you sort of look at what is going on within Britain during that time?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Hampstead is one of the games that I talk about there. So that was a text adventure, and you know, you would start off in it sounds very stereotypical looking back on it, but it would actually be very typical for a lot of people at that time that you would be in a poor council flat in London, and London at that time was perhaps not the same city that we understand it to be today. So it was during population decline. A lot of areas that are in poverty, and you would start off there, and this would bring home that fact through video games that this is a typical or certainly not untypical way of living your life. And I think one of the things you have to remember is that the coders at that time, they would actually be doing that. So as I said earlier, they might be supported by state benefits, but they weren't sitting around kind of, you know, drinking alcohol all day. They were trying to do something constructive with their time. And that's one of the things that they were doing there. So what they would, you know, they would code these games. But these were the kind of narratives that they would live with on a day-to-day basis. And they're putting that down in the game that they produced. And that was actually revisited by The Guardian not long back. And it's seen as a seminal game in the respect that it's an artifact of that time. So you could go back and listen to the music at that time, but the games also that were produced at that time would be the same way. And I also think that, you know, the way in which the chapter goes on to discuss race as well, which is in there as well. So it took, and music is a big thing. So we talked about chip tunes a bit earlier on, but also, you know, this was the way in which the race would be kind of portrayed through video games. And again, it was in that kind of urban context. So we do forget, and I think we do forget how dangerous the world was, you know, maybe 40 years ago. So we had the kind of threat of World War III, but also in the urban centres in the UK, Liverpool, Birmingham, London, there wasn't really a lot of integration. So, and riots were kind of, they weren't a daily occurrence, but they were frequent. And what video games like the character is Rocking Rodney, and the video game is, I can't remember the video game actually I was talking about there, so I apologize. But it's Ghetto Blaster, that's what it was. And, you know, it was plugging into that kind of idea that, you know, the existence of people in those environments is quite different to the way in which kind of white middle class people would live. So, you know, Rodney goes around to different places. He gets shaken down by the police. Adverts in the magazines that were promoting the game would have a picture of a policeman on there and Rocking Rodney trying to avoid it. And he goes to different places and he scores different types of drugs. And I don't think that was because that the coder who was Tony Gibson, he wasn't trying to do down people in that respect, but he was trying to tell a story through the medium of video games, which was probably trying to be told elsewhere. But actually, you know, gaming was a good way in which to show this, because people wouldn't just passively read it like in a newspaper or something like that, but they would actually be interacting with it and would understand the way in which, you know, music and drugs would go together within the kind of context of urban life within the UK. It's difficult because you can stereotype, so you can go too far and you can stereotype with this, but the games that he produced, I think, were consciously political. So he also did something around the UK government as well, where, you know, you pick up some kind of polluted seaweed and then go to 10 Downing Street and throw that at the UK government or UK cabinet, and they were very divisive as well. People would hate them and people would, you know, love them, and that's, you know, that's how divisive it was. And again, we see that kind of thing today as well. You see that in politics across the world. You see it in the US, you see it in the UK, very divided kind of nations, and those video games give a kind of narrative to that as well. So I think that's something that's very much overlooked, I think, the politics around games. And it's not just in the content, it's in the way in which they're produced as well.
Right. And sort of, you sort of conclude with sort of where we are now and gaming sort of still being on the margins. And so can you talk a little bit about that, sort of how you, your conclusion and where you see the importance of this and sort of where you see this situated right now?
Yeah, I think gaming is seen as marginalized. I think, you know, gaming doesn't do itself any favors. So it does seem to be that, you know, a lot of the bad habits that were inured in the 1980s and 1990s as well are still the same now. So you have this kind of predilection towards seeing that console gaming, for instance, which is seen as hardcore gaming, is a preserve of young males, and young males are stereotypically not, you know, they either don't look after themselves or they don't particularly care about other people. Now, I don't think that that's the case, because I just think that, again, is a kind of vociferous minority. But also the fact that, you know, the women who play games either don't speak up about it enough, and I don't think that's their fault, but they, you know, if you ask women if they play games, they would say they don't. So, for instance, my wife, you know, she, as you mentioned before, she played Candy Crush, and they say, are you a gamer? No. And I think that that's one of the things that, that's interesting. That they say they don't play video games, but they would, they do play video games, but they perhaps wouldn't identify with gaming. And, you know, it's a real cliche to say this, but video games and video gaming has an image problem. So EA, for instance, those economics around games that we talked about as well, you know, have these internal economies in arcades. Well, Electronic Arts introduced loot boxes into Star Wars Battlefront. And what they're doing there is they're saying, well, you can play Darth Vader if you want, but you have to spend either 2,000 hours getting to that point, or you can, you know, spend £200, for instance, unlocking that. And you know, that kind of thing, that abuse of gamers creates a very kind of toxic atmosphere between the publishers and the gamers. And that comes through in the way in which they seem to be they're very critical of games, but they're also very critical of other people. And it's a very defensive kind of attitude that they take towards other people. So forums that you go on, gaming forums can be quite nasty and quite toxic, and there is amazing criticality. Now, some of that is to do with lead time, so the fact it takes so long to develop a game, but some of that is a cultural thing, and it's unfortunately going to take the input of, you know, people who don't normally play games or won't admit to playing games to say, yes, I play games and it's part of my life. And this is what it means to me to bring that forward. And, you know, I'm sure most gamers aren't like that, and I know that's the case, but it is, again, it's the vociferous minority that take things through. It's always those extremes that get the traction. That then has to do with, you know, the way in which we use internet and social media as well, which are platforms for gaming themselves. So it's kind of circular in many respects.
Right, right. And that makes sense. This is your book, and I don't even know if this is this book, which will be becoming a movie, is popular in the UK at all. Ernest Cline's Ready Player One.
Okay, yeah.
Do you know that book?
Yeah, I have read that book. I read it a few years ago, yeah.
Yeah, it's coming out here in a couple of weeks as a major motion picture. But when I was reading your book, I thought of that, even though it's a novel, right? Because it sort of harkens back to sort of this 1980s video gaming, and even though it sort of moves into the future. So I wasn't sure if it had come up. There's talk. I don't know if it's going to be released in the UK or not, but it's got that similar sort of like that nostalgia to move back to the 1980s gaming, or at least have that knowledge of that 80s sort of gaming culture.
I think, you know, there's a couple of interesting things there. So the university that I work at in Birmingham is where they filmed some of those scenes. So early on in the filming, they were filming in Birmingham because it's the closest thing to how Ohio looked in the 1980s. So I guess that's, I don't know if it's a good reflection on Birmingham or not, to be honest, but I don't know how Ohio looks like. But it's also interesting, it's directed by Steven Spielberg. So, and he had already done the forward to Martin Amis's Invasion, the Space Invaders. So he's always been very into games. So I think that he, you know, in the 1980s, he had an arcade machine in his office, you know, so you would go to see him in Hollywood, wherever he was, and he would have games there. So that takes it through. I don't know if it actually comes out, but I do try to avoid a kind of nostalgic look at this. So, you know, I do feel that, you know, when I've just talked about being critical about games, the industry itself is its own worst enemy, but it's also the fact that I don't really want to bring that nostalgia to play on it. I want to look at it through a critical lens, and and seen it in that way. And I feel that Klein's novel, it's name dropping in many respects, it's bringing a lot of those kind of things out, and it will be, it cashes in on that kind of 1980s nostalgia. So we're all getting older now, so we're all, you know, buying Super Nintendos and Japanese sports cars and things like that as we go through our midlife crises. And one of those things is that, you know, we go back to the 1980s when, you know, Ghostbusters was around and Back to the Future, and it's wonderful and it's cozy and it reminds us of our childhood. But again, I'd always say that I think the world then was as dangerous, if not more dangerous than it is today. So I think that it's kind of misplaced, that nostalgia. I do feel that that's the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sort of gets at like all the happy things, but doesn't look at what you were starting to get at in that final chapter, right?
Yeah,
with really
right.
thinking about how these things sort of reflect some really dangerous times.
Yeah, definitely.
So we've been talking for a while. I don't know if you're working on anything now you want to sort of, for, you know, last shout out to a new project, or if there's any final things you want to mention about this book.
Yes. Yeah, so one of the things I was mentioning there was around, there's a section there called Disappearing into the Mirror. Now, during the 1980s, there was a software house called Mirrorsoft, and they're owned by Robert Maxwell, who also owned, he owned newspapers in the US, but he had kind of global interests around the world. And the work that I'm currently doing looks at the influence of Robert Maxwell on video games. So he had interests in Sinclair, so they developed the Spectrum, and he's had interests across video games in the UK and in the US as well. So there was a US video game company called Sphere, and they were involved in some kind of, it was never proven. In fact, they were innocent of any kind of wrongdoing in this, but there was he was moving money around to mask the fact that his companies were losing a lot of money. In actual fact, the video game companies that he owned were the only ones that were making, or one of the few companies that were making money for him. So those are the kind of histories that I'm looking at now, is the fact that there are certain people within video gaming history have massive influence, but have never really been looked at. And in actual fact, although I've done the kind of research on this and I've followed the money, actually getting that kind of thing published seems to be quite difficult. So I went to MIT Press and said, you know, asked them if they were interested, and they said, well, we don't really know who Robert Maxwell is, but he was a big name in the kind of 1980s and 1990s. So it's difficult sometimes to get recognition, I think, of how important these histories are, not just to video games, but to wider societies. And I always try and bring that to bear on it. It's a theoretical and data-driven exercise in finding out what's important. And it's not just about Britain, and it's not just about US. It's about, you know, bringing everything together globally, from Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and seeing the way these histories are, you know, constructed globally and how they then act at a kind of local level. So that's what I try to do. But actually, it's proving more and more difficult to get an audience for that. So I do appreciate you having me on tonight, and it's really good for you to have such an interest in that, as many, you know, US scholars do. So it's great for that.
Well, thanks so much for talking with me. Again, this is Alex Wade, whose book, Playback, A Genealogy of 1980s British Video Games. So thanks, Alex, for being here.
Thank you. I appreciate that.